Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, we've got Aki and Bree here. How are you two doing?
Coffee.
Lots
of coffee. Pretty good.
I'm almost fully awake now. Almost.
Wow, that was quick.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it doesn't, 15 it minutes doesn't... and you're up and running? Wow, holy sh...
Yeah, usually I'm awake faster than this even. It's just, you know, less than 4 hours of full sleep.
I envy you. Okay. Anyway, we've got a fun show lined up. Pernell will be here later on in the show to talk reviews with us in the second half. But before we get to that, we have an interview we've got to take care of. Joining us from lovely hell places, James Ragg. How are you doing, James?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks very much for having me on.
Pleasure to have you on. When I first saw Entropy, I was very intrigued by it. Before we dive into the game, I do have a very important question that will set the tone for this entire interview. And what makes a hell place lovely?
good question. I mean, the name came to me when I was spending like far too much time playing Dark Souls and, you know, back like 10 years ago. And, I think the weird thing is that if you're into video games, you probably do have a kind of strange, homely love of some of the kind of disgusting and vile places that you've subjected your 3D, you know, your video game characters to. You know, like Dark Souls is a great example, like of that world. I find it super nostalgic to go back there to like hang out at Firelink Shrine with all the kind of depressed half dead people. You know, they're not having a good time, but I am, you know. So I think that's a lovely hell place. It's basically like I think a lot of video games that we probably all play are kind of lovely hell places. You know, they're hell places, but they're kind of lovely, you know.
They're charming.
They have
some whimsy to them, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were here to chat about your game Entropy. For the people who don't know what this game is, give us the sales pitch. What is Entropy?
So Entropy is similar to our previous game, Dread Delusion. It's very narrative focused. It's got a heavy emphasis on story and character. But unlike our previous game, this one is a third person party RPG, kind of stepping almost into JRPG territory, although we have much kind of crunchier and deeper mechanics than a lot of JRPGs, in that we are introducing these almost Souls-like elements such as permadeath and kind of elements from more kind of CRPGs. Like Fallout 1 is a big inspiration with being able to target limbs and stuff. And much like Fallout 1, this is a kind of post-apocalyptic game, a dying earth scenario where everything is kind of grim and crumbling and covered in mushrooms. And I think we just put it out into early access, and kind of the first little bit of the game is playable there, about the first kind of quarter of the game, and people seem to be reacting really well. It's got a lot of positive feedback, so people are vibing with it, and yeah, that's Entropy.
The first thing that caught my eye, obviously, with this game is the visual style. We've seen an influx of games that have been taking after the early PS1 era graphics, the early Sega Saturn graphics, with low poly visuals, grainier visuals. What was
remakes?
What, Aki?
said D-makes. There's a lot of D-makes, yeah. And they all do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the decision behind going with a rougher visual style as opposed to something more modern and hand-drawn?
Yeah, so it was really how I kind of cut my teeth in game development in the first place. Like, when I started in game dev, which was like 10 years ago, this style wasn't really that widely used. Obviously, you had the retro scene of the kind of SNES-style graphics, you know, the kind of Mega Drive SNES-style games was widely used. But not many people were doing it with kind of early 3D, apart from, you know, there are a couple of creators, I would say. Lilith Zone was making Crypt Worlds, and Kitty Horror Show was making some amazing games that used this kind of low poly 3D, kind of slightly janky style. Like, the jank is kind of almost intentional. And that kind of spun out into the, not directly, but then what followed on was like the haunted PS1 scene. And they started releasing these things called the Haunted PS1 demo discs, which were kind of tongue-in-cheek references to the PlayStation 1 demo disc, and everything, all the games released on them had to use kind of PlayStation 1 shaders. So, you know how the PS1 has like janky polygons, and the polygons kind of move as you move the camera around?
Yeah,
like this, it turned out that, you know, I'm going back to like, this is like 2017, 2018, when this was going on. And yeah, it started to like gain traction rapidly. It turned out like people, for whatever reason, I mean, I don't think any of us, any of the developers on this scene, were really expecting it to get very big. I think we all just thought we were weirdos for liking it. But like, it clearly,
I mean,
like,
to be fair, you all still are. It's just a lot of other weirdos like it too. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, I wouldn't really trust someone who isn't a weirdo. You know, if you're
exactly
too deeply normal, like, what are you even doing? Yeah. So that's kind of like how I got started with it. And that scene was really fun, by the way. Like, the Haunted PS1 demo discs, I'd recommend people checking out, because they're just like full of super inventive, weird games. But to kind of, I mean, and it's almost like retroactively after the fact, I've tried to construct a narrative as to why these kind of retro 3D games kind of struck a chord with people. And I mean for me, I think a large part of it is that I think that the PlayStation 1 and N64 games were this era of this kind of Cambrian explosion of really, really interesting new takes on how to make a game, because you had all these small developers stretched around the world. You know, you had a lot of, you know, Tomb Raider, for instance, was made by like six people who in Britain who regularly just like went to the pub. This isn't, you know, this is very, very different from whatever the latest Tomb Raider, you know, however that's been made by, you know, literally thousands of people.
Yeah, now they have six people working on her hair.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You think it's that few? Oh my. Okay. Have you seen more clothes
here? Her
come
boot.
On now.
Yeah, so yeah, like but what they were all approaching the same problem, which is that like nobody had made 3D games before. Like, they were all 2D. They'd all been 2D. Now they were 3D, and that's a huge shift. And so like every game kind of approached it in a different way. And actually, like, Tomb Raider is an interesting example, because if you go back and play the original Tomb Raiders, like, they control like super weird. Like, you control,
yeah, terrible.
Well, I mean, the thing is that nowadays they're terrible, but the reason is because we've agreed on a homogenous control scheme for 3D games, where you use your left thumb to control your character, and you use your right thumb to control the camera. Now, we're getting deep into the weeds of like early 3D nerdery here, but I have the first game that ever did that. It's called Alien Resurrections, and it's a PlayStation 1 game, and it is the first game to ever do right analog stick camera, left analog stick movement. And this game got absolutely slated in reviews. Everyone was like, this control scheme is terrible. This will never catch on. This is like the worst way to control a game. And obviously, like, this is like COD, you know, it's just like Call of Duty controls. And so the point is that, like, back then, like, PlayStations were like marketed for people in like clubs and stuff. Like, they would put them in clubs with a load of drunk 20 somethings. And it was very much the idea of like, this is a kind of pro. If you don't have an established way that everyone just knows, like, this is how you control a 3D game, like, yeah, like, what is the best way to onboard just an entire generation of players into the 3D space? And I actually think, like, if you take your, you know, if you take your, like an elder relative, say, who's never really into video games, and you give them Call of Duty and you give them original Tomb Raider on the PS1, they will actually probably get on with Tomb Raider better, you know, because you can control it with just the D-pad, you know, because early PS1 controllers didn't even have analog sticks. They were just D-pad and buttons. So they, like, all PS1 games kind of had to allow for this in some way. I mean, it's also why, like, early like tank controls on Resident Evil and stuff, like the camera is placed for you and it removes that whole thing. Anyway, the point is, what's really interesting about this period of games is you go back to it and there's so many, some of these ideas are rubbish, you know, some of them haven't stood the test of time, but some of them really, like, have, and these ideas are worth stealing and pilfering and putting in your pocket. One such idea that we're using in Entropy is, I am a massive fan of the original PlayStation 1 Final Fantasy game world maps, which are these kind of like quite lo-fi little kind of diorama worlds that you can explore in like full 3D. And they're these abstract environments where you know, you can kind of walk across a continent. Yeah, it takes like 30 seconds to walk across a continent, you know. but I think this is a great... So now Final Fantasy games, obviously, like, they don't have world maps. They just have like really, really, really big levels. And if you actually can't walk across a continent because it would take you 10 hours and it would be incredibly boring. And and, you know, maybe and I'm just of the opinion that the way they did Final Fantasy games in the PS1 era is just more fun and a better way to tell a story than the way they make modern Final Fantasy games. And you know, I honestly, like, struggle with, like, the Final Fantasy VII remakes, for instance. Like, I just don't find them very fun. I don't find the way they've set up the games very fun. And mainly because of, I think, all the, like,
cuts. So pretty.
Yeah, no, and I enjoy, like, I really like the way they've done the characters. I really like I played the first one fine because that was, like, mostly just, like, kind of dinging you between set pieces, and the set pieces are really cool. I really like the characters, but I've just, like, bounced off the second one because they open up the map a lot more, and I don't like that, the style of open ended gameplay that they've gone for. And but yeah, there's a lot to love about the remakes. I'm definitely not, like, just hating on them for no reason. I would have preferred if they'd kind of actually just done a kind of like a simpler remake and kept all the kind of all the kind of like cool character voice acting and kind of 3D scenes, but then just like actually just made it as one game, as a 60-hour experience, and I think I would be happier. But yeah, so my broad point is that I think that the ways that they made games back then, there are still lessons to learn from. But I guess more so also, like, I do think that the aesthetic has a kind of punk charm to it. Like, there's something that's quite, like, I feel like, I mean, it's something I've said before, but it's like, if you look back through the history of art, there's a point where painters kind of like achieve realism, maybe in like the kind of like 18th and 19th centuries. You get to the point where like painters have actually just kind of figured out how to create a photorealistic scene with paint, and almost immediately the art scene just like pivots into like modernism, expressionism, cubism, and just like all these kind of like super weird art styles, and like the art scene just becomes that, and no one cares about photorealism anymore, because it's almost like as soon as you achieve photorealism, everyone gets bored of it and people want art to be kind of weird and cool and stylish instead. And I almost feel like that's the point where we're getting in the games industry. Like, we've done it, guys. We've got photorealistic graphics, we've got ray tracing, your PS5 is more has more computational power than like the entirety of computing before the year 2000 or something, you know, like and like immediately we're just like, oh, this is boring, let's have something like cool and punk and weird. And I think that the PS1 kind of style and the kind of pixel art textures and cool shaders and stuff, I just think it's like actually more interesting to look at than something that's trying to render a photo. Yeah,
I find a game like yours more intriguing and interesting to look at than something like Grand Theft Auto 6.
Yeah, I mean,
you heard it. Yours has soul and it has uniqueness to it, where Grand Theft Auto is just Grand Theft. It's just, I don't know. I feel like one of the only people on the planet who doesn't really care about Grand Theft Auto 6.
We're going to put that on the box art, by the way. You know, SML says better than GTA 6.
Go for it.
Yeah, literally everyone that was on the show yesterday announced how little they gave a shit about GTA 6. None of us cared. Not a single one of us. Yeah. And there were four of us on there. None of us cared.
Yeah, I watched the thing this morning, and I must say I was a bit like, I was just a bit like, why does everyone have to shoot each other? I don't know. Yeah. It's such a realistic depiction of like very, very, very bad crime. I don't know. But maybe that's just me signaling that I'm in my 30s. I don't know.
I don't know. I'm old too. I'm in my 40s. But going back to Entropy, I got to say, I really, really, really appreciate the fact that you have toggles for the CRT effect and the dithering, because I had to turn those off. What draws you to something like a CRT effect?
I mean, I play with the CRT effect off anyway. It's just that I think giving people options on how to stylize their thing is cool. And I mean, because the CRT effect, the whole point of that is that a lot of people who play old games will kind of swear by playing them on a CRT. I considered getting a CRT because I've got like 2 PlayStations, 2 PS2s, a GameCube, a 360, and more consoles hooked up to this TV in my like study, which is like where I do my kind of weirdo research. I've like, it's just like an HDMI TV, but it's like, it's one from like, I think like the late 2000s. So it has like all the inputs possible. Whereas now if you get a TV, it's just like, you know, 2 HDMIs and that's it. And also because it's old, it just like still works perfectly fine and it hasn't just like got planned obsolescence or whatever. But I've thought about replacing it with a CRT, but the trouble is I'm on the 5th floor of an old Victorian building
of
flats, and I just like, yeah, I'm just like, I could get a CRT, but I just don't want to carry it up the stairs. So.
No.
Yeah.
5 floors of a CRT. No, I lived on a third floor apartment, and that was enough for me carrying a TV up.
My friends live in
27 inches.
Yeah.
My friends live in Amsterdam, and they have actual like cranes on the top of the buildings, which are still sometimes used if you want to like put a sofa in the top floor of an Amsterdam flat. But, yeah, we don't. But Yeah, but so people swear by CRTs, and so it's a poor imitation just putting on a CRT filter, but it does create the same effect where it like blurs the pixels, and it's a different kind of style. Like, but most games, most like SNES games or PS1 games, were played on CRTs, and it would blur a lot of that low resolution together. Whereas actually, most of us now, when we play these kind of games, we're playing them through emulation on kind of a high def screen, and we're kind of more used to it looking like that now. But I guess it's a preference thing. Like, some people, although I will also say, at least one person has shared on the Steam community that they have played Entropy on an actual CRT. So
that's beautiful.
If I knew how to hook up my PC to a CRTV, I could do it, because I have a CRTV.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, you can try it. We also spent a while making sure that the UI would scale to like a 6x4 resolution, you know, like a CRT resolution, which was like, I mean, it was probably just like a few hours work, but I'm glad we did it just for that one person who played it on a CRT. It was all for them.
Made it all worth it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The biggest vibes I get from Entropy are Legend of Dragoon.
Oh, it's on my playlist, to be honest. I've not actually played it, but...
you need to immediately. It will be your most favorite of all games of all time, I promise you. Just
Aki is one of the biggest PlayStation haters I know, and she swears by Legend of Dragoon.
Okay.
Yeah, that ever since I've played that has been my number one game. Nothing has come close to being that amazing. I fucking love that game.
I've literally been looking up... It's on my kind of like eBay search list. Like, I've been looking up because I have I have like a weird kind of disease, which means that I will only kind of like play physical copies of things, and I won't emulate anything. Which is
that's called a conscience.
Yeah.
Well, this one's buyable on PS5, so I mean, that's not...
Yeah, I guess you can get it there if you really want to.
Not the same charm as playing off a... What was it? 4 discs was that one?
Yep, it was 4 discs.
Yeah.
It was 4. Yeah. It was 4 discs of fantastic greatness.
Yeah, and I also just like the kind of residual effect of like when you're putting actual discs in a console, you just, your brain slightly thinks just for a moment that maybe you can still get like a 90s price mortgage and you can get a house for like 10 grand or something.
Maybe
all the stuff that's happened since hasn't happened and we're still in 1997.
I miss the days of getting a cliffhanger in a game and then having to switch the disc.
Is that nice? Great.
It was such a like, oh, what happens next? I have to stand up and switch discs? No.
Yeah, I was like, RIP discs, by the way.
How do you feel about the death of physical?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to be honest, like, not. I don't really care that much because it's like, it's
really?
Not.
I'm surprised.
Well, it's just because, like, actually in this age of all I do with modern consoles, like, I sold my PS4 and I just got rid of all the games at CEX, which is our kind of the British version of, I guess, like, GameStop or something where, you know, you can trade in discs for money. And like, yeah, I just like sold my PS4, took all the discs to CEX, and I think I got like a tenner or something. So it was just like, well, that was just
about the same prices too. All right, cool.
Yeah. And like, it's just so with the PS5, I didn't even get a disc drive anyway, because I was just like, you know what? It's got to the point where it's like the laziness of just like, My kind of PS5 TV, which is downstairs, is quite far away from the sofa, and it's just gotten to the point where like the laziness of just having to get up and take a disc out the case with your tired thumbs and put it in the console is and it's like these, yeah, I don't know. I think part of it is just that I'm not that fussed about, Sony like owns us anyway. We've had to probably sign over all sorts of absolute nonsense in the in the user agreement. They probably own our firstborn child anyway, so
They do own your soul, so
yeah, you know. Exactly. No, it probably, I'm just like I'm just also like not that up to date with all the console stuff anyway. Like, I have a PS5, but and it's kind of like also because I mostly like use Steam and stuff, really enjoying using a Steam Deck and kind of plugging it into the TV and using the new Steam controller. And obviously that PC games haven't used discs for ages and ages. And it's kind of like a sad thing, but it was clearly going to happen. And I mean, the main thing is if they were to somehow ban PS1 discs, then I would be completely up in arms, you know, because I have a massive like PlayStation 1 games collection, and that is like very dear to me. So, but I don't think it's possible for them to ban PlayStation 1 discs, thankfully.
Yeah, that would be rough if they did.
So yeah. I also have a large collection of PS1 and PS2 JRPGs specifically.
Nice.
And I'm curious, because it says you're inspired by classic JRPGs for Entropy. Like, what were some of those influences?
I would say, I mean, it's kind of like pulling from a lot of stuff, really. Like, a big influence is Fallout 1, like the original Fallout mm-hmm. 1,
yeah.
Which is obviously a PC RPG, but it was from the same kind of era.
Yeah.
I think it was in like 1997.
Yeah.
And we take a lot of influence from Fallout 1. But then obviously, like I've said, the kind of like PlayStation 1 Final Fantasy games, also a massive influence on the visuals, especially, is Vagrant Story. Which is just like a fantastic game, just a really wonderful game. It was a late era PlayStation 1 game that was really pushing the console to its limits, and just incredible artistry. Like, when I was first getting into game dev and doing this kind of low poly thing, you can find a model viewer that someone's released online that allows you to pull apart all the game files and like load up the levels and stuff, and it's just like the artistry on like the textures are absolutely insane. Like, a lot of PlayStation 1 games will still just use kind of photo textures and stuff, but all of Vagrant Story textures are pixel art, and they did Final Fantasy Tactics before that, and so they kind of had a background in pixel art and clearly had all these pixel artists, and the texture work is just like absolutely next level, and same with the models and stuff. It's just like true absolute artistry. And one funny thing also is, you know, Final Fantasy 12, mm-hmm. That was done by the same kind of a lot of the same people, I think.
Huh.
And because it's the same like director, and I think it's ambiguous whether it's set in the same world. Like, the director has said differently on different occasions whether it is or isn't like a prequel to Vagrant Story. Like, it's kind of weird, but it might be set in the same world. But anyway, I've like downloaded some of those textures, and they're obviously like much higher resolution, but they actually like, and you can't tell as much because they're blurred. They're like mipmapped. But those are also still just like pixel art. So even in Final Fantasy 12, which was what, like a 2004 game or whatever, they're still doing all the textures in pixel art. And that's also why it looks absolutely fantastic, because they're like literally hand placing every pixel to make sure it looks as good as it possibly can on the PS2. But obviously there were loads of other games that inspired it, stuff like Sunless Skies and Seas and Sunless Skies, which are more kind of modern games, but are really influential on kind of dialogue and stuff. Similarly, games like Fear and Hunger, kind of newer, like Disco Elysium, obviously. Like even some like Zelda Wind Waker is one of my favorite games, and actually does influence my design decisions a lot. So yeah, even though like obviously we talk about retro 3D games and like older games, it's just as influenced by newer games, really. Like I'm pulling from a lot of newer game mechanics as well, like Dark Souls and just Soulsborne games in general are a huge influence to me, and I'm always trying to pull in some of those design decisions. Like one of my favorite things about Dark Souls games is that you just have like a consistent save file, and you don't really interact with saving and loading, which I've always found to be quite a quite a kind of like weird finickety part of game design. Like Fallout 1, for instance, the only reason the hero is able to save the day in Fallout 1 is because the hero has the quick save and quick load functions. And, you know, a lot of older games were like that, that were heavily reliant on like quick save, quick load to just be able to beat the thing. Because, and so with Entropy, we're thinking like, how do you kind of recreate some of that? So, so Entropy is similar to Dark Souls in that it's a kind of a permanent save. You can't roll back time. And if you die, your characters can die permanently. And the only character who can't die permanently is the main character, who for plot related reasons keeps getting like resurrected. So yeah, if you like die in Entropy, you're just kind of like forced to continue. And it's not actually, there's only a chance that your other characters can die. Like often they just kind of like suffer a wound or whatever. But I'm really into that kind of.
Is the chance
how likely? Die. I think it's like, only like
chance, is it?
So for a start, like in order, like we're trying to build it so that if you're like a careful player and you like build up, much like Dark Souls, if you're a careful player and you're like prepared and you kind of like do your due diligence, like it's entirely possible to just kind of not have people die, like, you know, you just like scrape through. And then if they do die, sorry?
That's how I'm playing. Ain't nobody on my team.
Yeah, and we're just about to push out a patch that nerfs crit damage, actually, because that's probably like one of the things that people are kind of raising issue with is that it's possible for your characters to get like one-shotted by like really big crits. Mm. So we're kind of nerfing that a bit and reducing the. And you know, this is something that we're going to continue to do over the early access period, is like get feedback from people and because yeah, we're aiming for that kind of level where like a death of a character should feel like quite a big thing. I think the chance is like I'd have to look in the actual code. I think it's like 20 or 30% to actually die, and then kind of like another equally big chance to get an injury, and then another equally big chance to like just be fine.
Okay.
So, but I'm not typically a fan of like early access, but I'd like to hear from a developer perspective, like why early access?
Well, I mean, really, just like what I was saying just then is a good example of it. Is yeah. That like you know, our publisher is JetXP, and they've got like a really good QA team. But nonetheless, like even a really good QA team is kind of like, you know, maybe less than a dozen people. But when you go into early access, you get literally thousands of people playing the game, and you get so much feedback from that you just can't recreate with any QA team, really. Like even if you were a really big budget studio, like, and yeah, this is also why, you know, big studios still release games that turn out to be like super buggy or like have crazy things wrong with them, is just because like the only way you can get that kind of really thorough feedback is from a big kind of beta test or early access. And so it gives us access to a huge amount of feedback from players. And it, in a way, it's kind of, as a developer, it's kind of like cheating, because you get to see the like meta game develop for your game before before like it's even out. So, and you can start tweaking things and balancing things, you know, while you're still making it, which I think is really, really useful. So, and I think it's fun for fans as well. Like, we did it with Dread Delusion, and people seem to really enjoy it. Like, people like, some people don't. Some people are just like, oh, I want to just wait for 1.0, and that's absolutely fine. And
I'm typically in that camp. Yeah.
I mean, I'd probably say that I am as well, to be honest, like most of the time.
I'm never in that camp. I'm a
But, you know, it's just, it's giving people different ways to play, and it does help us out with feedback. And it's, it also makes, this is maybe just like very specific to me, but I find it makes a 1.0 launch way less stressful, because, because you just like, releasing a game is kind of scary, and if you are releasing a 1.0 game and you've never really done any big public tests or anything, like, I don't know, I'd be kind of terrified. I mean, we've actually always done early access, so I've never actually done that, but I think I think it would be quite scary, to be honest.
Yeah,
because at least with this way, we can just like iterate kind of slowly over, you know, the process of a year or something, and just gradually react to feedback and slowly kind of tweak the game into something that is our vision, but also is kind of aligns with what players want as well. So yeah, I really enjoy it, to be honest.
So do you also watch streams of your games once they're out in the wild for feedback?
Yeah, of course. It's really weird watching a stream of your own game, though, because you just...
I bet.
Yeah. It's not like watching a stream for another game, because you're just like... you just see... I mean, it's really interesting as well to see people like react, because even with stuff like story beats and stuff, you'll find people come away with completely different interpretations than what you were hinting at and stuff, which is all, that's part of the artistic process. Like, you know, that's, but an author can't really, there's no real equivalent for like an author being able to like listen into the thoughts of their reader's mind while reading a book. You know, it's hard to kind of like play test a novel. I mean, obviously you can get like proofreaders and stuff, but it's not, it doesn't give you the same kind of like one-to-one, whereas like if you're watching a streamer who's just like vocalizing all their thoughts, it's like you are just entering the head of someone playing your game, and it's
yes, because good streamers do that, they just vocalize every dumb thought that comes in their head.
Yeah, which is actually like really, really good testing for a developer, because it's just like, oh wow, this is but it is like, as soon as I'm watching a stream, I'm just like immediately in like work mode, and I just like have to get a notebook, because I'm just like, you know, out, because I'm like, I need to be I need to be like noting down all the things that the player is bumping up against that might be like bugs or things they didn't intend or whatever. But
do you like to reveal yourself to the streamer that you're watching them, or do you like to just like sit in silence and monitor quietly?
I think I did with, I've not done that with Entropy. I think I did do that with Dread Delusion a couple of times, and it was kind of funny. But it's probably quite stressful for the streamer, to be honest, to be like, oh god, the developer's there.
That's
good for the streamer's health. It's fine. They need a little bit of extra stress. It's okay.
I know, right? story and character are key in Entropy. What does the process of world building look like for you?
So we like I think Dread Delusion, which was their previous game, was like 100,000 words or something. It was like a novel worth of words.
Right.
And we had, I probably wrote about a third of it, and then we had various other writers contributing, making up the rest. And Entropy's kind of shaping up to be about the same. Like most of what's in the build right now is my writing, and then a fair bit of Artyom, actually, who's our lead artist. But then we're kind of bringing in more writers, so over the course of development, it's going to get like more diverse. But we actually started Entropy with the lead writer of Dread Delusion, Io, who wrote The Clockwork Kingdom, which is many people's favorite area. I kind of sat down with her and we made together this like lore bible, where which is this really extensive document. And it's mostly like it was my initial ideas, but then Io is such an incredible writer that she like fleshed them out way into way more interesting developments. And she filled the lore document with little kind of asides and quotes. And it started with a poem, and the poem was just like so beautiful and so astoundingly well written that we ended up like opening the game with it, like the stanza that you see in the first. And every act is going to be a different stanza of this poem. So yeah, it's not the whole thing, but it's just, because Io is phenomenal. I mean, she studied English at Oxford University, so, you know, she's very clever. but she's also going to be writing like the biggest town in the game, which is called The Last Redoubt. And that's kind of her area for this game. So I gave her that area because it's probably one of the most important places you'll find in the game, because it's like, you know, the big city. Every RPG needs a big city, and so I think that's going to be really fun. But yeah, most of actually the writing process, to be honest, is we've got a big Discord, and we've got a bunch of people working on the game. We've actually got, like I just mentioned, we've got Artyom Trakhanov, who's a phenomenal comics artist, is our lead artist. But being a comics artist, he can write as well. And we've also brought on Linnea Sturte and Simon Roy, who are another two absolutely phenomenal comic artists who I would recommend anyone check out their work, because Simon Roy actually rebooted the Prophet series for Image Comics, which was their original idea, and just made it like so good. It's all about kind of clones of the original hero kind of being activated all across the solar system, and like Earth is like this very far future version of itself that's mostly inhabited by aliens who it's like super cool and weird. Linnea has worked on one of our most recent things is called like Garden of Spheres, which is and her artwork is absolutely beautiful. And all of these comic artists, I was all into them before I even got into game design. They've been working for a while, and they all make these kind of weird, super interesting, super introspective kind of post-apocalypses. Like specifically, a lot of their work deals with kind of far future ruined civilizations. And so basically everyone on the development team is super interested in this very specific world and thematic thing that we're doing. And so we're all just like super hyped about it, and we're all just bouncing ideas off each other, and we're all just kind of like fleshing out this world together. And honestly, it's like the most fun I've ever had in a workplace, you know.
Nice.
So what kind of feedback have you gotten so far from the game in early access?
You know, one thing that I think is really good is that with Dread Delusion, we got a lot of feedback that was just like, the combat is bad. Like, I don't like the combat. And that's completely fair, but it's also quite hard to iterate, you know, to actually work on, because it's like, such a broad and vague statement that you're like, is it like the animations? Is it the damage numbers? You know, it's quite hard to be specific.
To be fair, you also have to remember none of these people are professional writers.
Yeah.
Not exactly the most verbose.
Yeah, but they are usually right in that they are expressing something that is true to them, even if they don't have the vocabulary to express it. But with that sense, with Dread Delusion, it was because we prioritized story and exploration over combat, and that was a conscious choice because we were just a small team, and it was kind of like one of those things where it's like you could, one of those kind of humorous meme choices where it's like you can only have, there are three things and you can only have two, and it's like an agonizing like, oh god, you know. And yeah, good, so it was kind of like, yeah, so it was like, yeah, it's like combat, story, exploration, you can only pick two. It was kind of like that, and because we were just like, we were a small team making a basically an Elder Scrolls game, but it was like because, you know, we could have spent the whole development time of Dread Delusion just making a combat game. And even then, it just wouldn't have been as good as Dark Souls. Because, you know, but we actually could, with a small team, you can make a world that is just as interesting as Skyrim, or and actually has like just as good writing as Skyrim, because it's not, that's not required. That's not, you know, you don't actually need a team of 100 people to make a combat to do those things.
Especially if you want it competently made.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was our choice. And I like, you know, I think we did really well with Dread Delusion. I don't regret anything that we did there, but you know, I think there's some fair criticism that like the combat wasn't as good as maybe like some bigger budget games, which is like fair. But with Entropy, the kind of feedback we've been getting has been like way more specific, where it's not been like the combat is bad. It's like, oh, I don't like that critical hits can one-shot me, or like, oh, this, you know, this potion is underpowered. And I think that's like such a good sign that the feedback we're getting is like super specific, because it shows that actually like the systems we're making are broadly good, and the feedback people are having is like just specific tweaks. And actually, as a developer, that makes the job like so much easier, because it's just like usually if there's something that lots of people are saying, like if I usually tend to rule it by like, if just one person says a thing, you're just like, okay. But if five people say a thing or 10 people say a thing, then you're like, okay, right, yeah, this is something we should look into. And actually, I think it's meant that we've been able to like quite quickly like rebalance and tweak things in ways that both like align with our vision and also react to player feedback. And so yeah, like things are going really well. Actually, I think the feedback's been really good. Yeah.
Well, get your notepad, because I got two notes for you, and these are going to be harsh. Mm. I'm a mean guy. I don't think the invert Y option is working.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it actually starts in one of them. Actually starts inverted. I don't remember if it's the Y axis or the Y axis. Well, but when you start the game, one of them is inverted, even though it says it's not inverted.
Well, I had Y inverted off and it didn't feel right, and then I turned it on and it felt the same, and then I hit the button on my Elite controller that inverts the controller and it felt right. So something is funky with the invert Y. And then the only other real feedback I have is I love the music in the game, but after hearing like heavy hard rock during the battle, the post battle music is just lackluster. Like it's really high and energetic, and then just purr, 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 purr. That's my gripe in my time with the game, is the music. One song just doesn't fit right to me. Everything else
I'll pass that on to Dan, our composer, because Dan also is like constantly reworking all of his tracks all the time. It's like constantly sending me new versions of stuff, so he's also very kind of like respondent to feedback and stuff. And I think the invert Y thing is something we're aware of. I think this was another thing people have raised. I think it's probably going to be fixed in an upcoming update. I think I'm pretty sure we've looked into that, so yeah, both fair criticisms that we will address.
Very good. That's what my job is, to make sure that invert Y works. Team invert.
Yeah.
And weird people in their team invert.
You shut your face, Aki.
Dread Delusion came to consoles in March, and I totally missed it. How well was it received on consoles, and do you have any plans to bring Entropy to consoles after the game is finished?
Dread Delusion was received really well on consoles, I think. It seems to be doing good. To be perfectly honest, also, like, it's harder to get direct feedback with consoles than it is with Steam, because Steam has such a good tool set for like allowing fans to connect with developers. Whereas when it's on consoles, it's a little bit just like, like, the only real feedback I've seen has been on, like, Reddit, like, of people like, oh, I picked this game up on Switch or whatever. But actually, like, the feedback I've seen on Reddit has been really good. They're like, especially on Switch, I think people really enjoy it on, it was specific Switch 2. But I think all of the feedback I've heard on Switch 2 is people being like, oh, hey, this is, like, the perfect Switch 2 game. And it's like, oh, cool. Feedback's been good. As for Entropy consoles, being currently in development, I can neither confirm or deny the the question posed to me, but let's just say it would be pretty cool to get Entropy on consoles, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
I have a weird question.
Best kind.
Yeah. Just because I know how people are, and I know how vapidly stupid they are. You get a I'm going to go that route. You get a choice of three characters to pick at the start of the game. Have you seen any, let's say, people with IQs in dumpsters that have pushed back against that? Or has everyone been generally fine with that?
I'm just going to say yes. So we kind of joke that it's a that by having because there's a kind of like non-binary gender option in the character selection screen, which honestly, when we made it, I didn't really think about at all. It just seemed obvious because we have in this kind of it was just kind of like written into the lore of this world where people can have strange mutations and people can like be bat people or kind of like have three eyes or whatever. It just seemed kind of like glaringly obvious that there would also kind of be a kind of like non-binary gender. Like, this wasn't really something that we agonized over. And so the player can pick someone who is a non-binary gender, and obviously, being Steam, there's like a very small but very vocal minority of people who do not like this for reasons that I can only really ascribe to like fascism.
I don't know,
I would ascribe to that if I thought they had enough brain cells for that personally, but
but basically you just lock the Steam threads whenever anyone throws a hissy fit. And we've been joking in the dev team that it's just kind of like a good way to like filter out the kind of people who we probably don't want in the community anyway. So
yeah.
Nice. That is a lot better than a lot of devs do. A lot of devs just kind of are like, they kind of just let that conversation play out until they, for like weeks, and then they're like, okay, let's lock this topic now so we don't have to deal with this. And that's it.
I think something similar happened in Jed Delusion, but I think also that was because I think it was early on, I didn't realize I had the power to lock threads. And then, and I was like, oh wait, no, I can just get rid of this. Bye.
I can shut these idiots up.
Yeah.
And but to be you fair, can't put them in a blender yet.
To be fair, whenever that happens, it is like one person saying a nasty opinion, and then it's like 20 reasonable people just laying into them. But it's still just kind of like, this is kind of pointless. Like,
yeah, there's... I wish that subset of people would go back under the ground where they belong and just like...
Well, they probably do live in... They probably are in their parents' basements anyway.
Yeah, so. True.
Yeah, there's a TV show on, I think, Apple TV called Mythic Quest. And they are making like an MMO, and they find all these like fascists and like neo-Nazis and all this other stuff. And they actually lure them into this event and then move them to their own server so that they have their echo chamber. That was the easiest way they could figure out how to deal with them.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I've never actually watched it, but that's the Always Sunny guys, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I do need to watch that at some point, because I'm a big fan of It's Always Sunny.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I know we've been chatting for quite a while. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
No, not particularly. I think, no, it's been a really, been a really interesting chat. Yeah. You brought up some really good questions.
We try. Yeah, it's been enjoyable. It doesn't always work, but we try.
I'm just glad I got a question in this time, because usually I'm like, and that's all that we get out of me is about that.
You were useful, Aki.
Yay!
Yay! It Yay. Took long enough.
Oh, James, where can people keep up to date with you, your company, and with everything going on?
So you can check out my website, lovelyhellplace.com, although currently I just deleted it by accident. Like literally just like an hour ago, because I'm changing some stuff on the server.
And, I went to go load up the website and I was like, why is it 404ing? What happened?
Yeah, that's because I didn't realize that uninstalling WordPress on a site that doesn't use WordPress would delete the public HTML folder in the root directory. Geez. And so just like, I mean, it's fine. I've got like a backup of the website. Like I will fix it today. But it was just kind of like funny, because it's just like, oh gosh, God. It's gone. Yeah. It's just like,
yeah.
Whoops.
Wonder how long until the team's like, I don't know about letting you control this anymore.
Yeah. Oh God. I mean, I think if I could get someone else to do the control the website, that'd be great. But unfortunately, I think just no one else wants to. Fair. Yeah. But no. So yeah, you can also find me on Blue Sky, Lovely Hell Place. You can find me on Steam, Lovely Hell Place, and also our publisher Dread XP. Check out their games as well. They've got a lot of horror games. Very cool. Mostly just my website, which will probably be fixed soon, I promise. Hopefully in well, as soon as I get off this chat, I'm going to figure out how FTP servers work again. Or just generally Google Lovely Hell Place. You know, you can Google it. There we go.
Very good. Aki, any final questions on your end?
I had one in mind, but then we went through all that conversation part and I forgot it. So
I had a question, and then we talked about how I had a question, and then I forgot the question.
Basically, yeah, more Yay. Or less.
Bree, any final questions on your end?
I'm going to pull a Jacob, and I'm going to ask, what, if any, is your favorite kind of taco?
Taco, favorite type of taco.
I know that could be hard. Do you have tacos?
Especially in the UK. Tacos in the UK, but they're inferior.
Every culture has something like a taco or something like a dumpling.
Well, no, they have Taco Bell in the UK. It's just...
Just recently, it's significantly inferior. We don't really have... I mean, we've got, like, I think, like, mostly we would just, like, go for, like, Mexican food. Like, there's a great...
Yeah.
There's a couple of really great Mexican food places in Brighton, for instance. But, like, specifically the kind of, like, Taco Bell just taco as a kind of food institution, like, we don't really have in the UK. But recent, in the past kind of like few years, yeah, like Taco Bell has kind of come to the UK, and I think people just like don't really get it. Like, I think I had one recently and I thought it was awful. I'm sorry.
y'all's Taco Bell is terrible, and Taco Bell is not particularly good food in general on top of that. So you have, like, the worst of the worst.
But, like, there's a place near me, I live in Brighton, which is the very south of the UK, about an hour away from London by train. And it's basically like if you take San Francisco and just scale it down by, like, you know, like to like 0.1 size. I actually went to San Francisco, and like the Golden Gate Bridge is a park that is the size of Brighton. So like the Los Angeles, not Los Angeles, the San Francisco park is as big as Brighton. But otherwise it's kind of like exactly the same. We've got lots of hills and colorful houses, and there's this kind of hip kind of little hippie cafe that's been open for like 30 years that does super great Mexican food, and they do a wrap that's absolutely delicious. So that is that is my favorite taco.
There you go. All right. Thank you.
Awesome. And with that,
damn it.
Wacky.
I said, damn it. Now I want tacos so bad now.
Yep. Always.
Well, you can go get some because this is the end of our interview. James, I want to thank you so much for coming on, hanging out with us, chatting with us. Entropy is available now on Steam Early Access for what? $12?
I think it's less, actually. Is it just $10? I mean, we've got like a launch discount that might still be going, so I think it's even
I'm
less
seeing
than
$11.99 on my end.
I think we've the launch discount might also I'm thinking in pounds. Yeah, it's £8.99, but that is, I don't know actually what it is in dollars.
$11.99 USD if you are interested in checking it out. James, I want to thank you again for coming on. It has been an awesome chat. We are going to take a quick break. We will be back with more show in a little bit. We got Purnell coming on to do some reviews and some other fun stuff. James, do you have any final words to end the interview?
Yeah, just thanks so much for having me on. It's been an absolutely lovely chat, and yeah, it's been wonderful chatting to you guys, and I hope that you enjoy your post-show tacos.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another huge thanks to James for joining us and talking about Entropy. Aki, how was Entropy? Did you enjoy the chat?
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Good stuff. James Rag, good stuff. Lovely help place. I love that I asked the first question of what makes a lovely hell place.
Yeah, that was a good question.
Yeah. It's not often I have good questions, but I was proud of that one.
Nature finds
a way. I'm just glad I got a question out.
True, true.
That does not happen most of the time. I am usually just so overwhelmed. So that was nice.
Yeah.
I only got one, but I made it count. I don't remember what the hell I asked, but I know. But it, you gave us a conversation
because it's been 4 days, and I have no memory. Also, exactly. Joining us right now, we've got Pernell hanging out.
You're breaking the illusion, Joe. You're breaking the illusion because you're talking before you were announced,
Lloyd. Lloyd's here.
I thought Lloyd was saying he was breaking up.
No. Joe is breaking the illusion by saying it was 4 days ago.
When it was really like 12.
It wasn't that far ago.
Damn it. Now you're breaking the illusion more, you rat bastard.
It was Friday, you wiener.
The secret is there is no illusion. It just was.
Here's more illusion. We already recorded next week's episode.
Wait, what?
It's a shocker.
We did?
Jesus Christ, Aki. You'll find out next week.
On Dragon Ball Z.
I hope the fuck not.
So, Lloyd, how are you doing? How's things?
Things are.
That's a fact, usually, yes.
Yeah, mostly okay. Got rid of something that was taking up space in the trunk of my car.
A dead body?
So... No,
you're a sweet bippy.
You're no fun.
Two dead bodies?
No, it was only a chair.
Is that my chair?
Housing a dead body?
That's your chair.
Yay, my chair was eating up space in your vehicle.
Was a dead body at any point sitting in the chair?
Probably not. But there's a half-dead body painted on it.
You know what? I'll fucking take it at this point. Goddamn.
The important part.
That's so mean to John Cena that he's half dead.
I saw how he walked out of that last match.
Yeah, that's I guess that could be a little bit of news that we could talk about. Lloyd, you hooked me up with a pretty dope ass chair for a couple of bucks. I picked up a full sized folding chair for John Cena's retirement tour that they would have at ringside, and it is awesome.
I'm
glad.
Yeah, it's
like
a cool chair,
and I'm glad it went to you.
Yeah, it's a dope looking thing. I love it. I swung it at people already. I ran outside and I chased the mailman. No, that's a lie. I didn't do that.
Just keep the cats away from it.
Oh, absolutely. They are not going near that thing. Oh my god! If they clawed that thing up, they would be outside. Like we are
until tomorrow. He beat me to it. Until tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd let him back in. Okay, love you. Please don't be mad at
you, Snuggle Buckle.
Baby kitty.
And the cat's like, piss on the floor. I love you too.
Shit in your shoe.
Cats are adorable, but goddamn, they don't give a shit.
No, they don't.
Maybe it's because they know. Deep down, it's like, they love us. I don't owe them shit. They could always get rid of us, but they don't.
It's not necessarily that they love us. They think we're incompetent, stupid fucks that they have to take care of.
I mean, I am.
Yeah, it's that old thing about dogs think, hey, these people look after me and my every wish. They must be gods. Whereas cats are like, these people look after me and my every wish. I must be a god.
And how accurate. Wrong they are.
Accurate. Very accurate.
Wake me up when you cook your own food, cat.
By the way, I think this is the first time I've been on a show with Pernell. So, Pernell, nice meeting you.
Hi, pleasure to meet you as well.
Has it been the first time?
I think so.
I think so, because I think I've always been on the other couple of times I've been on has been Thursday shows.
Ah, why did I think you've done Tuesday before?
No, this Adam's is my first Tuesday.
Crazy.
One has to wonder.
No, one really doesn't.
Sure they do.
Effort.
And I've been on more often to talk news than for actual reviews, which is going to make it a Thursday right there.
Yeah.
I mean, someone has to talk news because it sure shit ain't me.
Very true. Very true. But
I think a couple of weeks ago you came up with a news story, Aki.
Yeah, I've come up with like five in what?
This year?
Almost a decade? No, not this year. God, no. That'd be great.
She tries. Every now and then she tries.
Yes, okay, Aki is very
bless
trying.
Her heart.
She tries her bestest.
I really don't, but I do occasionally try, but not my bestest. That's a lot of effort, you guys.
Well, you're going to try this episode because you have some good games to talk about.
Well, I have some games to talk about, yeah.
Yeah. Should we talk about these games? We got five games to discuss on this show. Should we dive into these?
If you
want to. Why the heck not?
Sure.
All right, first game tonight is Metal Gear Solid Master Collection Volume 2, developed, published, provided to us for this coverage by Konami. Thank you, Konami. Aki, say thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
She does. She's very excited about this one. It released August 27th on Xbox Series X and S and PS5. I forgot to write the price down for this one. Is it $49.99?
Fuck if I know. Oh. For me, it was free.
Womp womp. The extreme tension of infiltrating without being detected. Metal Gear series, the pinnacle of stealth action. Immerse yourself in the Metal Gear series, the pinnacle of stealth action. Very repetitive. Where you can infiltrate and elude your enemies to complete missions. This collection is the second installment of the definitive Metal Gear Master Collection. Aki, what is in Metal Gear Solid Master Collection Volume 2, and is it worth picking up?
Okay, so I'm going
and
to admit
it is $49.99.
Okay, cool. I'm going to admit I'm coming from this as an Xbox player, not as a PlayStation player. So there is quite a difference between people's opinions, possibly with that. I wanted this for one very, very specific reason. This has Metal Gear Solid 4 on it. And that was always on the PS3, I think it was.
Yep.
And
yep.
Nothing the fuck else.
The system I bought the system that came with it.
Yeah.
And
so, like,
played it.
Once I knew that was going to be on it, I was like, well, then I want this because I've always wanted to play that game. Like, that. Because it's very reminiscent of, like, Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater, which is my favorite one, and somewhat close to the Phantom Pain, which is 5, which I also really like. So I was like, I really want to play this. And it really doesn't hurt that some of the main people in this are 4 really attractive women who are the bad guys. So, you know, I'm not going to complain. That's just life. So for me, I was super excited about it just because that's in it. But there's also Peace Walker, which if you're a Metal Gear fan, you on any console, you've probably played. And they also have, as one of their the tiny little bonus games, like the first edition had Metal Gear 1 and 2. This one has Metal Gear Solid
Ghost Babel?
Yep. Okay.
2000 Game Boy version or Game Boy Color, maybe?
Okay, yeah, that might be right. Yeah, for some reason I had it in my head that it was a Super Nintendo game, but I was like,
you would know
better than me, because I didn't get into these games until the HD collection came out on Xbox. So. But yeah, so those are the games that come with it. Obviously, they also include, you know, all sorts of the screen writing books, which is basically take all the dialogue and everything else in the game and write it down instead, and there you go. You also get giant manual thing, art books, I guess is what they'd be called. I don't remember. Oh, they're called master books. And they basically just have a bunch of art in it, and they talk about different characters. It's kind of like if you got an old guide for something, but instead of having all the guide, it was just information and lore about the game. It's that. It's really cool. And yeah, it's just those games, though. So we're getting slightly fewer games than the prior one, but this is pretty big because people on Xbox never got to play 4. So yeah, in Peace Walker, you are helping by taking out these giant machines, more Metal Gears, basically. There's 3 of them, and you're building your own. And unlike most of the other games, this isn't just a straight playthrough of the game. Instead, this is very much like Phantom Pain or Ground Zeroes, where it is mission-based, and you can go back and replay those missions. It's fairly fun. I've enjoyed it both times I've played it, because, again, this was in the HD collection that I originally played forever ago. And, yeah, you're going around just killing these things, and you're building your own Metal Gear even with it, the Metal Gear Zeke, which is really fun. Sadly, you don't get to actually pilot it or anything. It's mostly sent on little missions while you play the standard game. There's lots of stuff that you can develop in the game, and you're bringing people onto Mother Base to raise, you know, different ranks, be it food or intelligence, research, so on and so forth, so you can build new items and advance them. So, you know, eventually you get the ability to build rations or new types of guns, things like that. Very a la Phantom Pain in that aspect, because that's where they got it from. Metal Gear Solid 4, on the other hand, is
again, this is the showcase and the highlight of this package.
Yeah, at least for us on Xbox. I think for people on PlayStation, I think it's actually the other way around. but in Metal Gear Solid 4, you're playing as maybe a different Snake. I'm not really sure. The lore of Metal Gear is fucked. Yeah, that's what I'll go with. It's fucked. And he has become an old man. He shouldn't be, but he has a weird problem that has caused him to age very rapidly. He doesn't have long left to live, so he's going after Liquid Snake, his brother and enemy, who has developed his own paramilitary group, and now you're going after him to stop him from whatever machinations he has, because he's just an all-around bad dude. And yeah, in this one, you play it just like lots of the other games. It is just a straight shot all the way through to get to the ending, not episodic or anything. You find weapons from enemies. A lot of them end up being locked, because in this world, it's all about people having nanomachines in them, so you have to get them specially unlocked and stuff by talking to a weapons dealer who can basically void the IDs on them, which is a big mechanic of this game. So every weapon that you pick up, if you already have that one in your inventory, it gets sold, so you get points, so you can buy new weapons or unlock weapon IDs that you already have, buy more ammunition, things like that. And it actually takes into consideration the real-world time on your systems, on your console, even. Because on Wednesday and Sunday, I think it is, there's I believe 20 or 25% off of everything. And the moment it flips over to that day, that full day, anything you buy is slightly cheaper, which is kind of funny. And yeah, he is basically going out to stop Liquid Snake, and Liquid Snake has a few young ladies who are mentally unwell, and they're basically his super soldiers, and you're trying to defeat them to get to him, as well as his frog units is what they call them, the frogs, and they're made out of entirely women. And yeah, it's pretty fun. It's not super long in the amount of chapters it has. There's only a prologue and then five chapters and then the end of the game. But the levels are pretty large.
And the cutscenes last forever.
Yes, they fucking do. There's also a mechanic in this game, and you do need to be aware of it if you care about achievements. There's a flashback system in this game, and you have to get all of the flashbacks. And all of them are in specific cutscenes. And that means you can't just skip those cutscenes. You can skip the other ones, but
why
you can't
would you skip
ones.
Cutscenes in a Metal Gear game, anyway.
Because maybe you've already watched them, and you're just like, I literally just watched this yesterday, and I don't need to watch it again, which is something I did. So you have to make sure you don't skip the ones where you have the flashback, because you have to activate that flashback. It's just hitting A at specific times when they're talking about certain things. You can just tap it, and basically it shows you screenshots, just quick flashes of screenshots from earlier games in reference to whatever they're talking about. For instance, they bring up one of the Metal Gears, and when you hit A, it actually shows pictures from, I believe, Metal Gear Solid 1 of that. Whereas, you know, other characters might be mentioned, and it shows whatever game they first appeared in, and so on and so forth. And yeah, it's a really nice action
game. How far in did you get to Metal Gear Solid 4?
I got into Chapter 2 and then started all over again because I realized I missed a whole bunch of stuff I wanted to go get to make my life easier later in the game.
They have the cutscene where they made fun of swapping discs and explain that now we have Blu-rays?
I don't remember that, so I don't know if I hit that or if I was paying full attention at that point, because I did play this straight through the night a couple times and was not fully cognizant the entire time. But that does not sound familiar. Yeah, that I have words.
Because I know on PS3 they made a joke in one of the cutscenes about having to swap discs, and then it's like, oh wait, no, we're on a Blu-ray disc. We don't need to do that.
I have a feeling it's probably still in there, because a lot of things that are in it, like all the references to PlayStations, like when you're controlling a little robot that can help you out in the field, Snake actually pulls out a PlayStation controller to control it. I think it's a PlayStation 3 controller specifically. One of the characters has a PSP that they play pretty regularly in some of the cutscenes.
So they basically kept all the Sony product placement. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I have a feeling that stuff is probably still in there. Realistically, it's most likely still in there.
Cool.
Yeah,
well, let's discuss the price on the package. It is being sold as a bundle. It's also being sold individually. Peace Walker's $20. What do you think?
Worth it. I really like Peace Walker. It's really good, and it's made for co-op, so get a friend.
Very good. Metal Gear Solid 4 is $29.99. Thoughts?
Totally worth it. I fucking love this game. Especially if you didn't play it on the PlayStation way back when, and this is your first time with it. Yeah, definitely. It's amazing.
Very good. And then the bundle is $49.99. It comes with both games, and then it comes with the Metal Gear Ghost Babel game and a digital soundtrack. So thoughts on the whole package at $50?
I'm totally for it. I think that's probably the route you should take, just so you can get some extra goodies with it. Because the soundtracks are pretty nice, and just having a little tiny game to just faff about with for free is fun.
I will note it does not have Xbox achievements that I am aware of. If they update that.
No, it does not.
It'd be cool.
They probably won't. I don't think
the Super Dodgeball pre-order bonus never got achievements either, so I was bummed about that. It's classified as a demo. It has a demo banner on it. Like, come on.
Yeah, I don't think the first volumes, Metal Gear and Metal Gear 2, I don't think either of those had achievements either, if I'm remembering correctly. Because, it's been a while.
Anyway, next game to talk about is Golf-tacular, developed and published by Both Good. Released August 27th, Xbox, Play Anywhere, Switch, and PS5 for $9.99. Golf-tacular is mini-golf. Barely. Mix party game chaos and dumb fun with precision and strategy. When we get golf games, we think of Lloyd. And Lloyd, you are here to talk about Golf-tacular, correct?
Correct, although I don't know why you think about me when it comes to golf games.
Something about golf with friends and you being addicted and putting in 10,000 hours.
I'm not addicted. I've only put in 500 hours and got the 100% on four different platforms.
Oh, well, then I was thinking.
Yeah, he's not addicted. He could stop anytime he wanted. He just chose it to be after he 100%ed it four different places, which I believe is literally every different place.
I haven't actually technically stopped because I still play it every once in a while. But Golf-tacular. So when you boot up Golf-tacular, which is the Xbox Play Anywhere, by the way, so it works on PC and console. I tried it on both.
Very good.
It gives you a menu where you can choose multiplayer or single player. If you go single player, it offers you puzzle or solo tour. I'll start with solo tour because I can cover the basics of how the game works there. So if you pick solo tour, you start off picking one of eight different golfers. And the golfers look different, but they each have a different set of starting power-ups. And once you pick your golfer, you pick which tour you want to play. There are seven different tours plus one that's random. So eight options. Each tour is a set of four holes. Once you are in there, before you take your first shot, you can pick which power-ups you want to use for that shot, if any. You get five energy, and each power-up has a set amount of energy it uses, so you can get any combination as long as it doesn't go above a total of five energy per shot. Once you use a power-up, it's gone, but after each hole, you get a chance to pick two more out of three that are offered to you. Scoring is done like regular golf, lowest number of shots, and the game does keep track of your shots, your total shots over the tour from one round to the next. So you can see how you did previously and try to keep improving it. So let's take a look at puzzle. With puzzle mode, there are 40 different puzzles, and in each puzzle, you have 1 to 3 stars that you can earn and a coin to collect. If you sink the ball, that's your first star. If you do it in a certain number of strokes, depending on how few strokes, that'll be either 2 or 3 stars. Most of the puzzles are to get 3 stars, you need to do it in 1 stroke, and then you need to collect the coin as part of that. If the ball touches a coin, it collects it. So nothing special there. Each puzzle gives you a different set of power-ups for that specific puzzle. Same thing, you have 5 energy, and you pick which power-ups you want to use for each stroke. I played through the first 12 of the 40 puzzles, and I have all the coins and all the stars. And most of those I was able to do within the first two attempts at it. I think the hardest one took me five tries. So it's not difficult if you've played mini golf games before. But some of them are interesting in trying to figure them out. Oh, and for control, it has the control scheme, which I like, which is moving the left stick left and right, aims your shot forward and back, adjusts your power. You don't have to like flick the stick to make the shot. You just adjust the power you want, press A, shot goes off.
Yeah, that's how it should be. So, that's how I like golf games.
Yeah, I've played enough golf games to see lots of other control methods. This is my preferred. I will say that some of the visuals in the game, there are some courses or some holes that are in wireframe only. And some of those gave me a little bit of eye strain.
Mm.
I don't think Aki would do well with some of these holes.
I'm sure I wouldn't.
Yeah. But overall, that visual thing about the wireframe, the ones that are fully filled in, don't look bad. They're pretty basic visuals, but they serve their purpose. So any questions on the single-player stuff before I move on to multiplayer?
No.
Okay. Well, the first thing you need to know about multiplayer is it's 2 to 4 players, and it's local only. There is no online play.
Nah.
Well, that's a shame.
Yeah.
But with the limited number of courses and holes, I guess it's not that huge of a deal.
Yeah, I would like to see them expand the number of courses before they worry too much about online. But they should do one of those, in my opinion, because there aren't a lot of holes. There are 40 puzzles at the rate I've been going through them is not much. But I don't know how complex or difficult the final ones are going to be. So if you do have people there with you and you get into the local multiplayer, you have an option of everybody having their own controller or pass the pad. You can play with a single controller. And it just cycles through players. So I'd take my turn, Joe would take his turn, Aki hers, and then would be back to me. No matter what our shots were, it always cycles through like that. There are a couple extra power-ups in the multiplayer that aren't in single player, but they're things like protect your ball from other players that don't make sense in single player. So there's no reason to have them there. Otherwise, the multiplayer is the same as the solo tours. So I'm not sure how much more there is to say about it.
Yeah, I put some time into this one as well. I thought it was an enjoyable experience overall. I just wish there was more to it. It feels like this was made as a puzzle game and the courses were kind of done as an afterthought, it feels. Just because of how limited the courses are and how limited the number of holes are per course. Like, playing 4 holes is like, come on, give me more.
Yeah. And I don't know that the solo tour was tacked on after they came up with the puzzle aspect, but the multiplayer being local only feels like a bit of an afterthought.
Yeah. Yeah, it really feels like this was made as a puzzle game first, and the rest was like, well, it's a golf game. We should probably have some golf courses in here. But it clocks in at $10, which I think is a fairly good price for what's here. What are your thoughts on this game at $10?
Well, at $10, I would say if you're looking for a mini golf game to play online, this is not it.
No.
If the solo stuff sounded interesting at all, yeah, it is fun. There's fun to be had in this. The puzzles are interesting. And I would say it's definitely a try it if you can get it on sale, like for $5. It becomes a fuck it, why not? Because it is fun.
Well, if people are interested, if you are hanging out and chat with us, you can get a shot at winning this. The people at Both Good were nice enough to get us an extra copy, which will go to one of you later on tonight. So you should hang out and chat with us on Tuesdays and Thursdays when we do this live, because you could win stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do when I can. Note,
Lloyd, it is always good having you on. We will let you get going. Do you have any final thoughts, final words?
Yes. You should always speak the truth, but leave before it makes people mad.
There.
I love how he says that and immediately leaves.
Good, because I was going to get mad.
Skill.
How dare he? How dare he? Next game to talk about is 1666 Amsterdam, developed and published by Panache Digital Games. It released August 25th, Steam Early Access for $29.99. Every 333 years, something stirs. 1666 Amsterdam is a third-person, dark, story-led action-adventure where Noah the Collector wields witchcraft to uncover demonic entities hidden behind human faces. Investigate by day, face your demons at night. Aki, what is 1666 Amsterdam?
Okay, so this is a game, and this was this has a big history to it that's kind of important, and so some other information. Originally, the developer who made the game worked at Ubisoft and could not keep the rights to the game for some reason, and had to have a big old fight about it legally, and finally got it back. And so when I tell you about the game, you might be like, that sounds like an Assassin's Creed game. Yeah. Hexy. It does. For a reason. And so, yeah, you're playing as this young witch through part of the game as a young man named Aaron, and as another young girl that I forgot the name of because she's a tangential character that you play as. And it is split between three different time periods. 1666, I believe 1996? And whatever is supposed to be current day in universe for them. And basically, you're playing as a young woman who has gotten a letter from her father after he has since passed away, but it has some magical weirdness to it, and you bring it to one of the people that he used to know, who is a massive linguist type person. Like, can you figure this shit out? Because everything on the page is moving like it's alive, and I don't know what the hell it says. And it turns out that your father had some sort of connection to a group of witches that goes way, way far back, and it flips between her being informed of this and then going into the letter and then later on into a book. And it goes into his lifetime with him and his girlfriend, fiance, wife, whatever it was supposed to be, who happens to be a witch who's part of this clan of witches from way back when. And he gets sent spiritually all the way back to 1666, and his soul is jettisoned into a kitty cat because plot says so.
Into a
cat. No one ever explains it to me. And yeah. So the witch in 1666 has basically their familiar. As everyone knows, witches have familiars. They have a tendency to be cats, black cats specifically. So you get to pick which cat he is. 90% of them look the same. There's like 12-ish of them, and all of them basically looked the exact same to me, and we'll explain why later on. And yeah, so you, at that point, you're playing as the witch, but you can also switch over to the cat, because the cat can get into places the witch can't, because the cat is, you know, a cat. It is not, you know, 5 times, 10 times, whatever the size that it is, so we can get into areas people can't. So it's mostly used to get enemies to come towards it by meowing, or it's hopping up onto high ledges that the witch can't get to, or it's going into windows to find latches to push so doors can be opened, things like that. Very interesting concept. I do like it. And then the witch, otherwise, is walking around, dealing with people, using magic. You have a standard form and a witch form that you can switch between with the push of a button. Anytime you're in the witch form, people start to freak out, and they will just continue to freak out as long as you're in it until they eventually call the guards. And once the guards are called on you, it doesn't matter where you go, or if you switch back into your non-witch form, they're going to fight you. And then you have to sit there and fight waves of them until they eventually realize, oh shit, someone with magic might be ever so slightly stronger than we are. And then they run away. At that point, your combat becomes harder the next time you get pulled into combat, because it raises your threat level, basically. However, as long as they haven't been alerted to it, you can switch back to your peasant clothing, I guess we'll call it, and eventually people's fear will start to dissipate until it's back to the base, like no one even notices you exist, because you're just some other woman in the crowd. And yeah, when you're a witch, you have access to some magic. The magic is not very useful, realistically speaking. It's not because the spells themselves aren't useful. It's because you can't use those spells on next to anything is kind of the problem. Like, one of the first spells you get access to is the ability to set things on fire. People are not included on this, so you can't use it in combat, which sucks, realistically speaking. Instead, it's used on torches, candles, things like that to light up your path, in case you have your settings set to where anything, even a minuscule of darkness, is pitch black. Then there's also an ability to destroy something, is another magic ability, and it turns whatever you do use that on basically into a grenade. It just explodes and destroys anything around it, including enemies, which is great. You can't use it on enemies, which drives me nuts. Instead, you can only use it on like groups of boxes and stuff that are around, and it'll destroy that entire group of boxes, not a box on it, just the whole thing, which means now you can't use that anymore because it doesn't exist. And this is basically used so you can take out enemies without going into combat, basically as a not quite stealth way of doing it, but the closest this game's going to come to with using stealth. Because, again, once you go into your witch form, which is the only time you can use magic, people start freaking out. But as long as the guards don't see you using it, it still just increases slowly over time, because people apparently don't freak out from you using magic, but if you swing your stick around, which is what you use to beat up people when you're in a fight, that freaks them out real bad. But you using black magic apparently doesn't, even though this is set during the witch hunting days. So it should be the other fucking direction. And you also get the ability to cast a magic on the water that allows you to basically just float at high speeds across it, which is actually really fun. I actually really enjoy doing that. And now we come to why there's some problems in the game. The combat is very basic. You have two buttons, a dodge and whack a bitch with a stick until they're dead. The dodge is finicky and more than half the time doesn't really work. Stick works fine. It's, you know, they have guns in this age, I'm pretty sure, and you're still using, I have a big stick. We could do better with weapons here, folks. Come on now, please. And then lots of the other stuff, like how I said you could go into the cat to unlock doors and stuff. It's supposed to be useful. It ends up not being super useful because the levels are all made in such a way that you can actually completely bypass that ability, even including the specific area where you're supposed to be learning how to use that ability. I happened to completely bypass it and get into the room just by walking through a different door. That realistically shouldn't have even existed, and if it did, it should have been locked too, because you're trying to teach people how to use these abilities. You know, standard tutorial stuff. Now, the reason why all of this happens and why there's changes in character models occasionally is because the head of this company really likes AI. Stated there's no AI in the finished product, but then also states, well, there's some in the prologue, but we're going to get rid of it. But also has stated in interviews, there was so much AI, there's no way we could have gotten rid of it all because I don't even know what all was and was not AI anymore. And I've also played it, and I'm pretty sure there's AI all over it. And there's no warning on Steam about any AI being used in it.
People are not happy that there is zero AI disclosure on Steam. People are making us think about it on the forums. Their excuse is that there's none in the game now.
Allegedly. I don't believe that.
I don't believe it either, but that's their excuse.
And yeah, from I what I think,
if
play,
it was used
really
at all during development, it should be disclosed.
Yeah, well, apparently, from what they're claiming, it was originally used as like background art and stuff that they have since completely replaced with fully human-made art. One caveat, apparently, to this that they haven't thought of or don't want to mention is the cover art for the game is AI-made. like, the active cover art of the game that is on the Steam page, it is AI made. It has, I'm pretty sure from playing it, it feels like there's a bunch of AI stuff in it. I do not know for sure, but it feels like there's still a bunch in it, which is kind of upsetting because I like the concept of the game, but there's just a lot of weird shit. Like, when you're playing as Aaron, the first time you meet him, you're going into a hotel. There is no point in which any fragment of that hotel is made in a way to resemble a place that could actually possibly exist, because you're going through corners and making turns and stuff, and it's like you would have made a circle here at some point, you would have ended up outside a building somewhere at other points, and then you end up going up to your hotel room, and it's not even a hotel room, it's an apartment, but it's a hotel. And for anyone here who's ever had an apartment or a hotel room, you know that there's a clear, concise difference between the two.
I mean, and some what people they're living do live in hotels.
But you can tell from the interior of it, they're different. There's just a difference there. And what he clearly has is an apartment. It's in a hotel, and none of the floor structuring is in any way possible. And you don't get that from normal people who know what hotels are like.
You don't get that from laying things out and planning things, but
exactly. So
we gotta talk price on this one. It is in early access right now. I believe they plan to be in early access for, where is it? About, can't find it. Why can't I read this?
Because your eyesight's bad? You're old?
No, it's difficult to accurately predict precisely how long it will last. So there you go. We expect it to take approximately a year with multiple major updates. The price will go up as content is added. You could get in now at $30. What are your thoughts on this one?
If you really want to support AI games, you might want to get on this sooner rather than later, because with them not disclosing the AI stuff, they're probably going to get kicked off of Steam. Because that's against Steam's terms of service.
Yeah, but we'll see if Steam actually does anything or not.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's okay. It has a lot of problems with combat and stuff. So if you don't mind handing AI games money, I would recommend waiting, see if the combat gets more polished, see if, the other mechanics like using the cat actually becomes something that you need to do, stuff like that. Because it has an interesting concept. It has not a great follow-through currently. So I think it's definitely a wait if you're at all interested. If you're not interested, I completely understand. But otherwise, it's a wait to see what they do with it.
All right. Let's move on to Moonlighter 2, The Endless Vault, developed by Digital Sun, published by 11-Bit Studios. It released September 2nd, Xbox Play Anywhere, Switch 2, PS5, and released to 1.0 on PC for $29.99. Experience an action RPG with roguelike elements where you live the double life of an adventurer and a merchant. Dive into vibrant dimensions to fight enemies, gather loot, and manage your backpack, then rebuild your shop and turn profits into gear for the next adventure. Pernell, what is Moonlighter 2, The Endless Vault?
Well, it's the sequel to Moonlighter 1, is it not?
Yes.
I don't think it is, no.
Oh, really? I'll be damned.
Well, then, I will...
Get a completely original game in the Moonlighter universe. No, this is the sequel to Moonlighter 1. In fact, it follows directly after the conclusion of that game, because apparently the people in the village that the main character lived in are ousted by a villain who decides he wants to collect their village because it has access to interdimensional portal travel. So they get ejected and have to take up residency in another town, which none of the people there, well, some of them, I'm sure, but most of the people there are not particularly fond of that, including the main character's friend. But the main character hasn't really let up a beat. He still is working, running a shop for some person who lives in town, because the way that they are able to keep a roof over their heads, else they'd be ejected into the street like a couple of scurvy dogs. But fate intervened one day when a massive vault, one might even call it the Endless Vault, crashes down in the center of town. It's actually seeking out the main character, saying, "I can grant your wildest dream if you prove that you are a powerful merchant and amass stupid amounts of money." They actually say it that way. No, they don't, but they should have. So that pretty much triggers the motivation for your main character's quest, because the anything you want, by according to the game character's accounts, could mean getting their town back from the collector. So that's a goal. That's a reason. That's why you be moonlighting once again. The way this works is that the game takes place over a series of two types of phases. There is the dungeon crawling phase. And whereas in the original game, you actually explored dungeons like in a Zelda-esque fashion, room by room, in this game, it takes on more of a action roguelike structure that uses the node system from Slay the Spire. As in, you're going from left to right, choosing what event you want to engage in, selecting that event, going to that space and taking care of the event, potentially getting rewards, and then progressing onward until the end. Most of these events will involve some form of combat to get the reward that lies within. And I will say the combat in this game is actually pretty fun. It doesn't go too balls to the wall or anything, but it's an enjoyable loop. You have four different weapon types you can engage with: a sword, a great sword, a spear and brass knuckles, or some form of knuckle. I've specifically used the knuckle almost indefinitely because I just like them that much. But you choose what you want, because each weapon has its own style of combat and its own type of special attack associated with it. These weapons can be upgraded in town at the blacksmith. You have the proper resources, but I digress. In addition to that, you also have access to a firearm that you can use, The firearm is primarily good at attacking from a distance or taking enemies out of the sky should they fly up there to engage you in combat. Though, in order to use the gun, you have to charge it by beating the stuffing out of enemies with your regular melee weapon. Fun format that goes back and forth. I enjoy it. Sometimes you might get perks when you complete a room. Perks can be things related to features of the game, and they have a variety of different categories, many of which I didn't understand what they meant. For example, the ignite type or the foam type. I don't know what they mean, but what I do know is that the effects you get from them are awesome. For example, the ignite type. Oh, wait, that's what it means. When you ignite enemies, generally that ability lets you do the igniting in the first place, but it usually involves when you ignite an enemy, X, Y, Z happens. These sorts of things happen. Chances are foam is a status I've never really noticed because I was too busy punching guys. It didn't just happen when it wanted to, but the foam effects are pretty decent too. And there's a multitude of different special effects that you can get for either your attacks, your weapons, your hunting ability, and what have you. The treasure in this game, however, is the main kit and caboodle of the game because, one, you acquired the dungeon, and two, it's the main component of the second part of the game. When you sometimes clear rooms, you'll get access to treasure chests, and these treasure chests combined contain various items. These items come with a rarity level, as well as a quality level. Quality level dictates how much money the product goes for. Like, for example, the item sells for $20. If you have a specific level of quality, that will multiply that 20 by whatever number is associated with the quality, thereby giving it a bonus on the sale, but you don't have to actually dictate what that amount is when you make the guesstimate. I'll talk about what the hell that means later. Some items also come with curses as well, because the treasure chest system in this game is actually a grid that is composed of multiple squares, with each item taking up one square. Some curses will alter or affect items in other squares depending on where you place them. For example, you might get an item that if you put it in the treasure chest, it'll burn the item to the right. Burning items is not good, but there are some items that have perks based on if things get burned or if it itself is burned. Because, for example, you burn something once, nothing happens. You burn it again while it's ignited, and it fizzles out when you lose it. So play it safe, play it smart. And different dungeons will actually have different types of effects that may come into play in this puzzle shipping. So it's kind of fun to go on a dungeon and go, oh, what's the effect that I'm going to deal with here? And it's going to engage how you affect how you decide to place items in boxes and how you decide you want to ramp up getting higher quality stuff. Eventually, whether it's because you're about to get your ass kicked or you have gotten your ass kicked, it will be time to leave the dungeon. When that happens, you will take every item that you've acquired within the dungeon out with you, and then you can take it to your store. Your store can be outfitted with a multitude of different furniture items and mech decorations, which can be acquired throughout different systems that the game comprises of. And that can be used to affect how things sell, how much it sells for, what items get prioritized in sales, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of interesting little effects that take place here. When you go into the store and you have everything set up the way you want, you then have to go and choose what items go on what pedestals to be sold. And even the pedestals have different effects, so choose wisely on how that applies. You might get more money by putting this type of item on this type of pedestal. It's part of the fun of customizing your shop to get the most bang for your buck. When you're ready to open the store, hit that dinger, customers start walking in and they are perusing your wares to see what they want to take home with them. Customers don't talk. Because if they did, how would your antisocial ass get by? You wouldn't handle it. But what they do is they will make facial expressions based on how they feel about the prices that you've set. If you need a price that is so low that you were an absolute moron to have done so, the customer's face will light up with gold sparkly eyes indicating, wow, they're getting this for a stupid deal. And they're going to buy it. And you kind of lost money. The opposite end of that spectrum, if they see a really angry face with a little angry pulsating vein in their head, that indicates that your price is off the walls ridiculous and they're not paying that shit. And they walk out their store flat out. They're just done. They don't want to have it. That's also your indication to hurry up, get over to the counter and adjust the price because clearly you overshot that bad boy. But then there's also the just right where it's pretty much the optimal price for the product. And then there's one level above that where it's a little bit more than it should go for, but the customer reluctantly buys it. You might be asking yourself, well,
if they'll buy it reluctantly, why not just sell everything for that much money? And the reason is because this game introduces a tipping system, or tip bonus system. The more items you sell at the sweet spot, the faster the gauge fills up. And when it fills up past thresholds, you can go to your counter and unlock various bonuses for your shop that will exist for the remainder of that day. Unless they're instant bonuses, like an instant $200 in your tip jar. So there's an interesting fun balance to selling items at the right price and foregoing a profit, or going all out and selling it for the most gouging price you can without them walking out of the store. I honestly enjoy this system very much. I am a sucker for games that involve me running a shop. If you couldn't tell from some of the other games I reviewed on this show, my first time playing an MMO, I worked as a weapon salesman. I didn't even go dungeon hunting. I just bought and sold people's stuff. That's how I roll. So, yeah, this works for me quite a bit, this, to borrow a term from Aki. And I will say that while I did miss the dungeoning system of the previous game, due to the way all the systems in this game, you know, work together and come together, I do prefer the play of this game. And I didn't even mention the fact that there's multiple elements in town that you can access to upgrade yourself, whether it's upgrading your gun, upgrading your weapons, purchasing some armor, increasing the spaces in your bag or slots available in your bag, or so on and so forth. There's other things that you can discover for yourself. There's just a lot that you can do in this game. It seems simple at first with one hub, with a few things you can interact with, and then a few dungeons. But when you get caught up in that loop, it becomes pretty addictive, and you might not find yourself being capable of stopping until dinner.
Yeah. So are you enjoying it?
Oh, yeah. It's great.
It's been in early access for quite a while, finally going to full release. What are your thoughts on this thing?
Well, I kind of dodged it on the early access because I told myself, well, I'm not biting, chomping at the bit to get it. I'll wait. And I'm kind of glad I did because I can talk about it here now. And I honestly feel like this game is really good. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it gets the loop just right. I think the combat is not overly complicated. It has just enough notes to make you feel like you're engaged. I forgot to mention, sometimes you can hit guys with your bag and send them flying off the screen like Smash Brothers. So, nice. Yeah, there's that too. But yeah, I think they did a lot with this game to make it work. They got the loop just right to make it addictive and have you feeling one more run, one more run. And yeah, I have had a night or two where I stayed up past like 3 a.m. getting that one more run.
All right. Well, let's talk price. Clocks in at $30. What are your thoughts?
Easy buy it recommendation. I can't go wrong with this one.
Very good. Grab it now. It is finally out today. So there you go. One last game to talk about tonight, Sucker for Love, Crush Landing, developed by Akabaka, published by Black Lantern Collective. It released August 31st on Steam for $12.99. Put the love in Lovecraftian horror when a captivating comet named Haley crashes into your apartment. You're drawn into an interplanetary conflict between light and dark. Feed Haley's fire to save the world in this horror comedy visual novel, and maybe even win a smooch. Aki, did you get the smooch?
No.
Haha, no, I did you not. Suck.
Yeah.
So what is Sucker for Love?
Sucker for Love. Okay, so in this, you play as a young man. He is a host. For those of you who aren't familiar with Japan, basically, it's someone that you pay to go on dates with you, more or less. It's a pretend boyfriend or girlfriend. In other words, it's a hoe that doesn't have to have sex with you, and you still give them a ton of money. Yay! And yeah, you're on a date with this woman who knows you from the club, and she's giving you money because y'all are from the club. And then you see a giant meteor heading for... Oh, fuck, that's your apartment. Oh, shit, it landed in your room. Well, that's... We better go check that. And then you head there, and you get this really weird meteorite that's just sitting on your toppled stuff. The building isn't on fire for some reason, even though the meteorite is burning in lots of different pretty colors. And you're like, okay, well, I gotta go call some people, see what the hell's going on. First people you call is the police, because this game is at least somewhat reasonable. And then it immediately goes unreasonable as they laugh in your face because you called it a meteor instead of a meteorite. Meteors up in space, a meteorite is after it's landed. Or maybe I have them backwards. I don't remember because I'm not a pedantic fuck. But apparently these cops are. So they laugh at you, hang up, and you're like, well, huh. So you call someone else to see if there's a way to sell it or if there's any experts on this stuff, because you don't know if this shit's dangerous to you. You're also now going to have to fix all this shit. Like, there's some problems here. And then you're told, hey, yeah, see if it's magnetic. Try to attach a fridge magnet to it. So you do that. And the fridge magnet just disappears once you touch it to it. And you're like, oh, well, that's a thing that happened. And soon after, another version of you pops up. And it is a multicolored creation that doesn't have any like specific facial features or anything. Like, it has eyes and a general concept of a face, but like there's no mouth or nose holes or anything else like that. And it just starts repeating the things you're saying to try and speak with you. And you quickly get it to turn into a female variant instead, based off of some Grav idol, which is basically typically a big titty idol who goes around, has pictures taken of them in swimsuits and stuff. And yeah, you start hitting on it because you're a host club guy and that's your job. So you have to keep this thing alive until the researchers get there. And to do that, you have to continue to feed the flames on the meteor. The problem is, the more you feed the flames, the more it decides to just take that color out of, I guess, out of existence, maybe? And you can oversaturate it in that color, which basically destroys stuff of that color. And you have like six different colors that you have to feed it in order to get a good ending. And you have to keep it to where you don't overfeed it any of those colors and basically destroy things of that color. All while you have like a 20-ish minute long or something like that timer where you have to keep it alive, because it's slowly, its fire will start to peter out over time if you're not feeding it things. So you have to find a good balance between feeding it stuff and basically letting it starve in order to get a positive ending. And you have to find things of these six different colors to try and feed it without overfeeding it a specific color. It's fucking weird. There are, I think, 13 different endings for the game, I think. Or maybe there's 13 different good endings for the game. I'm not entirely sure. There's a lot for these games. These games all have a lot of endings in them. And I got a not-so-good one and a neutral one. I have not gotten a good one yet. I am trying. I am failing continuously, but I am trying. And yeah, it's just fun, because basically you're just looking around your apartment room to find what you can feed it, and occasionally people will call you or they'll knock on your door, and you have to figure out how to deal with them, what to say to them. For some of them, you can just straight up hang up or close the door in their face and just ignore them, or you can try to use them for your benefit to get different things in order to feed this fire somehow. And it's just interesting. It's all real quick. You can play through this very, very quickly. You can get through it in like maybe 20, 30 minutes. You can do a run. Yeah, this is very quick, but there are a lot of runs, and you might get an achievement every couple of runs, maybe, if you're lucky. So, yeah, I've managed to get one achievement, and I've done three runs, and I've gotten one achievement.
That's proud it. Of you.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get more.
Well, there's should like we talk 13. Price on this one?
Yeah.
$13, what do you think?
I think it's worth it. It's a pretty short game, but you're expected to play through it a fuck ton of times. And that's like a dollar every like 20, 30 minutes. I think that's okay.
Are you going to continue playing it a fuck ton of times?
I'm going to play it until I get every different ending if I can.
Nice.
Whether there's an achievement for it or not, I just want to see all the endings because I'm obsessive.
Cool. Well, on that note, we are finished. Big thanks to you. Yeah, we are finished. We are done. It is the end of the show. Thanks to you two for being here, hanging out for this whole segment. Thanks to Lloyd for coming on, doing his review earlier. Big thanks to James Ragg at Lovely Hell Place for coming on and chatting with us about Entropy, which is available now on Steam. Music. I have no idea what I'm going to play. What do you think of that?
Ass.
It'll be in.
Ass music.
Well, since we talked about A Lovely Hell Place, how about we just play something from Hell with What the Heck from the 1UPs?
But that's not from Hell. That's Heck.
It is.
That's a completely different town.
The song's What the Heck. The actual place is Hell. Ask Earthworm Jim. He was there.
Okay, I guess I'll trust you this time.
All right. Anyone have any final words to end the show?
No. I'm groovy.
Groovy. Do your best, Earthworm Jim. Groovy.
Groovy.
Aki?
I don't know anything about Earthworm Jim.
Groovy!
He's such a groovy guy. How could you not?
Groovy!
Like a battle suit or something?
Well, yeah.
I at least know what the concept is of it.
Just the pew pew. Yeah,
see, you know more than you thought. Now that's groovy! We'll be right back.